We'll call the meeting to order at 8:25. The clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum present. Department of Administration left off yesterday with faith-based initiatives, and we're starting with reverse auction today. This is a process that started, I believe, 2 years ago. It was authorized by the legislature. I don't know if you have, do you have a demonstration for us, or is this just an overview today? And
Mr. Chair, I'm Kent Allen from the Materials Management Division of ADMIN. I don't have a demonstration.
Okay.
We'd be happy to bring one back. It's actually kind of fun to see. So if you'd ever like to see it, it's kind of running out either in your committee room, or we'd always invite you to one in a live one taking place, and that's it's been kind of exciting for people to see those. So we'll facilitate that any way you'd like.
Okay. We may take you up on the offer of having one in committee. I know we had one with Chairman Haas last year, just because members were skittish about even authorizing this to start with, and I thought it was a good idea myself, but I was very interested in how it worked, and a lot of times we get questions from other members of the legislature on how it works because they're not on the committee. So can you just give us a little run-through of the history of this and how it's worked, and are the savings gleaned to the agencies, the general fund, both, whatever, so... Go ahead and give us the ideas on this.
Mr. Chair, this is actually the first element of a presentation that deals in a broader sense with the topic of state procurement and contracting. That was on the list of things that you asked ADMIN to address. Some of you will remember that I was here earlier in the session talking about professional technical contracting, and some of the elements of that that got attention at the time included performance measures that we're using, some foreign outsourcing issues, and so forth. I'm not going to go back into any of that. The material I'm going to cover today, starting with the reverse auctions, is really focused on existing or new opportunities that we believe are available to save money through the state procurement process. One thing I will repeat from that earlier presentation, just to give some context for all of this, is the conclusion of the Governing Magazine survey that came out earlier this year. And it ranked Minnesota as one of 10 states where procurement and contracting is a strength. And the quote, and this is one I used with you before, and it's the only thing I'm going to repeat, is that few states are stronger in their use of solid managerial practices to govern contracting. So a little more context, just to remind you of how bad things can get when procurement and contracting goes afoul. Examples from a couple other states over the last year to a year and a half. Governor of Connecticut resigned over a contracting scandal and was sentenced to prison last week. In Florida, several public officials resigned, and $2.5 million worth of awarded IT contracts were canceled after their Auditor General concluded that the evaluation process had been flawed. So, in Minnesota, no news has largely been good news in this area. One of the things where we have achieved some recognition nationally as the lead state is in the use of reverse auctions. And that's what the first slide is looking at here. As Chairman Seifert pointed out, the authority to use reverse auctions has been around for a couple of years only. First, in 2001, we received legislative approval to use this method as it relates to goods exclusively. In 2003, that was expanded a bit to allow us to use it for two types of professional service contracts, specifically engineering design and computer consulting. As the slide shows you, we've had 151 auctions to date, and we actually compare the price we get in the reverse auction to the price that we get in a paper bid that we run concurrently with the reverse auction. And we can demonstrate to date $1.9 million in actual savings through this process. And some of these are for one-time buys. Some of these are for term contracts. And if we ran out those term contracts over the life of the contracts, those savings go up to $4.6 million. And these figures are growing regularly as we continue to run the auctions. The piece that's been a little harder to get some traction on, because for whatever reason agencies have not been been eager to necessarily be the first ones to try it is in the professional technical services area. But we think we're starting to make some major strides here, and I'll tell you why. We've run only three to date, even though we've had the authority since 2003, but they've all been in the last several months. They've been for the Departments of Public Safety and Human Services. They each involve computer contracting, and in these three reverse auctions, those agencies have saved over $50,000 in service costs. The other thing that makes us really convinced that we're going to be using this a lot more is that we set up an entirely new master contract program through the Office of Technology of Administration. They have master contracts in place for computer consultants. And as a requirement of getting on the contract list, when this program was reopened in the last several months, we required interested vendors to agree that they would participate in reverse auctions. And that's entirely new as a requirement to participate in a program of this nature. We thought that vendors might say, we're not willing to do that. Interestingly, 272 different computer consulting vendors responded affirmatively, agreeing that to get on this list, they would be willing to participate in reverse auctions. And we've already got contracts signed with 87 of those vendors. So we think we're really opening the door on a new and major opportunity here. However, we're still missing one savings opportunity that relates to reverse auctions, and that ties to the fact that statutorily we have somewhat limited scope in when we can use them. As I mentioned, we have full authority for commodities and for a couple types of professional technical services. We have no authority to run reverse auctions on other types of services. We really think that's a missed opportunity. It sometimes even ties into our ability to use reverse auctions for commodities, because some of our commodity contracts combine the purchase of a commodity with installation or servicing of the product. And in those cases, we can't use the reverse auction technique because of this limited authority. So we do think that's one missed opportunity. Recently, we've been beginning to use the same software that we use for the reverse auctions to do some online auctions of surplus goods. You might have seen the publicity in the last month or so regarding sale of the governor's Navigator. This was done online. We had an offer of $10,000 from a dealership for that vehicle. It had a cracked engine block, so it probably wasn't the most prime Navigator for sale in the state. But when we got some media attention and using the online auction program, the sale price of that Navigator went from $10,000 to $16,900. Several of you were at the Surplus Services facility in the last week, met the cat, had a good tour generally, I understand. So I won't go through all of the elements of the slide here, because I think this is kind of what you were exposed to firsthand when you were there. Obviously, it's the state's facility to do everything we can to reuse, recycle, and conserve the state's resources. But I'll tell you a little bit about the auction on Saturday, since when you were there, some of those of you who were there got to see some preparation for that auction. And my understanding is that you'd expressed interest in some of the items for sale, and I can tell you a little bit about how we did. 603 people showed up, even though the weather left a lot to be desired. It was last Saturday, the day after the snowstorm. We achieved $538,000 in sales. That was 138 vehicles and some other things. Some of you have been looking at a bus, again, with a blown engine. We got $200 for that. The Winnebago that had no seats in it. I don't know how the guy drove it home. I guess standing up. $85. The hydraulic press that someone had spotted. $425. The range. you think that's more than it's worth? A steel. Oh, okay. The range of items, the highest priced thing sold was one of MnDOT's pickups for $12,000. They averaged $10,635. The lowest priced thing sold was a bicycle for 25 cents. I would hate to imagine the state of that bicycle, but a 25 cent bicycle was the bargain of the day. As you'll see on the slide, 12 more live auctions planned for the year. Next one, April 23rd, again at the warehouse facility that you toured. More upcoming in Detroit Lakes, Grand Rapids, Bemidji.
Mr. Allen, just a couple questions on that. The committee went and saw several highway patrol vehicles that were there. What were those roughly?
I've got a list of what everything sold for, but it might take me a while to find it on the list.
Okay. That was one thing that people were interested in.
Kind of scan that and let me know what you find.
Or you can make a copy of the list, otherwise I don't... Oh, there she is. You were so kind to take us through your facility the other day. We can make a copy of the list when you're done with it or whatever, but that was probably... I know on the DOT trucks, I have a bill relating to surplus sales later that will have DOT testify a little bit as to why there were trucks that looked like they were brand new being auctioned off, and we'll get to that in a few minutes, but this is a public safety issue, obviously.
So, which is the sales rate? Mm-hmm. What's the other one? Okay. Mr. Chairman, it looked as though there were 10 or so Crown Victorias on the list. The blue book for... each was in the 2,800 to $4,000 range, and the prices that we got, a low of 41. Oh, sorry, low of 3,200 on the one whose blue book was 2,800, and a high of 54. 55 on one whose blue book was 4,040.
Okay. All right, do we have any other questions on either reverse auction or on the flip side, the surplus sales auction? Representative Blaine and then De La Forest. Representative Blaine.
I have a question. I was there on the tour, and I want to say thank you to the department for allowing us that could attend that. We had a great time. I got a couple of questions. Did they sell that deuce and a half that was parked out there?
It's that big green Army truck that either Ripley or somebody. I think that's on the federal sale. But we could make copies of this for the committee if they're more curious than what we maybe have time for.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Blaine, that was apparently federal property, and that wouldn't have been on sale at this
that's
last auction on
that's
Saturday.
That's on the June auction, right?
Okay, we'll be back for that. But
what we'd like to hear.
Going back to... your first presentation about the reverse auction, you had said that there was some opportunities that are being missed on because of the jurisdiction that you have to create reverse auction on some of these. And I'm just curious if the department has made attempts to move legislation or have members move legislation to expand the authority to expand reverse auction there.
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Blaine, when we first proposed the reverse auction language, we proposed it very broadly for goods and services, and all that we could get past that year was goods, and that was fine with us. It gave us a chance to start experimenting with it. We haven't affirmatively pushed language to expand it since, and frankly, our concern has been that the authority that's there might be reversed because it doesn't always make the vendors who are subject to that approach happy. We don't have a bill this year.
Mr. Chair, sir, you had said too that you had the authority since 03, but you had only three, if I understood you correctly, you only had three takers on involved in the reverse auction process, but you were able to show some significant savings there. And I'm just curious as to why other departments or others are not looking at this more aggressively, if it helps them save money within their budget.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's been a little bit of a mystery to us, too. We really thought it would be easier to get folks trying this. I mean, I really see it as a no-risk process, because if you don't get a better price, you're in the same shape you'd be in if you hadn't tried it. And my part of admin will do most of the extra work involved for the agency, so it seems like a no-lose situation. So I'm a little confused, too, as to why it's been a challenge to get agencies involved. I mean, I can see why the vendors would balk, because it puts them in a more competitive situation, and we can drive the price down. I guess I don't have a very good answer to your question. I've been disappointed with the eagerness to try it.
Well, Mr. Chair, and sir, I think that's why we made the decision to go to reverse auction, because it gave us another tool to show fiscal responsibility out there. If it obviously, if this makes here more of our departments here will look more aggressively at using reverse auction, especially those that will come to before this committee to be asking for funding, I would like to see them show to us some better fiscal responsibility. But appreciate you being here this morning.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative, we do believe that this new master contract program that we have will put agencies in a position where they'll be much more highly motivated to use that process. For the easiest way for them to contract for consulting services will be to use the reverse auction process.
Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Allen, I apologize for missing the initial portion of your presentation. My question is, what is the department's view currently of reverse auction with respect to engineering consulting services or engineering design services?
Mr. Allen, is that allowed, or is that, I know it was floating around last year.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have not used it in that area yet. We've had numerous discussions with the industry who is concerned with the use in that area, and I think what we've recognized that the clearer opportunity is in the computer consulting area, so we've started there to test the water, have told the engineering community that at some point we will want to try it with them as well, but we haven't done that to date.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as members know, I think that reverse auction can be very beneficial for things, perhaps paper clips and pencils, but I do have a concern when we get into very technical, highly skilled areas such as engineering consulting, where safety is certainly a concern. I'd sort of use the analogy, I'm not exactly interested in getting on an airplane from an airline that advertises they spend the least on engine maintenance, and I think that some of the same principles apply. So I certainly will be watching this issue very closely.
Representative Olberger, you're not going to fly Northwest then.
Hey, I'm taking America West. It's you.
Okay, any other questions on the auction side? My CLA is making copies of the results of the auction. So, Representative Kahn, we were looking at buying one of those mini buses. We'll see how much they sold for. Are the mini buses on there? Okay, so we'll see what they went for when we get the results back. Why don't we move on to procurement? And I have bills that relate to some of these areas, and what we're going to try to do is get the department through the presentation, and then we're going to get to my bills. I have Mr. Dahl here, and then we have Mr. Wally, Mr. Edwards with Representative Finstead's bill. So we'll try to do is get through the process here in the next 20 minutes or so, and then we're going to get to the bills. So, Mr. Allen, let's go on to procurement, if you would.
Certainly, although if I could just make one more comment in response to Representative De La Forest's concern.
Sure.
I appreciate the issue you raise, and the way we've tried to deal with it on the professional technical side, We certainly agree you don't just want the cheapest intellectual resource available, be it your doctor or your engineer or anybody whose brain power you're relying on. You don't just want the person who's going to do the work for the least amount of money. So the process that we've been using on when we're dealing with professional services is to do a pre-qualification process where no one even gets into an auction unless they fully met the agency's full set of expectations with respect to qualifications, experience, skill levels, past performance. Cost doesn't become an issue unless they get over the bar on all those other matters. So that's the way that we deal with the concern that you could end up with somebody who's cheap but not qualified.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Allen, of course, the concern furthermore, I appreciate your argument, but more than that, there's a temptation sometimes to cut corners if the margins get too small. And that may get up to an ethical line, but I'm not suggesting that for those particular vendors. But there can be a temptation to cut corners and go for an 80% solution as opposed to the 100% solution. And again, my argument, if we get an inferior quality of toilet paper for the state office building, you know, that's not as big of a deal as opposed to a scenario where you may get an engineering firm that's turning a lot of work over to their new employees and less experienced employees who bill at a lower rate than you might otherwise get in a situation that isn't dealing with reverse auction. You know, I understand that there are arguments to be made on both sides. I'm not hostile to reverse auction, but as mentioned, it's something that Representative Leader on the other side of the aisle and I have been concerned about, as you know, and will continue to look at the situation.
Hey, Mr. Allen?
Let me continue to talk about a couple of other opportunities that would be available to the state if we consciously chose to change some of our strategies or approaches with respect to procurement. And these are some other areas where we feel that there is the potential for a meaningful savings through the procurement process. Current law involves a determination of best value when awarding contracts. And there's a reasonable amount of flexibility in how best value is determined. And historically, the approach that admin has used is to rely largely on the agencies to define precisely what they want to buy. There's also a legislative requirement that we divvy up the state's business and attempt to distribute it geographically to some degree. And vendors have a reasonable expectation that they're going to get a shot at some share of Minnesota businesses. So the combination of those interests and approaches has led to a procurement strategy in Minnesota where we award lots of contracts, including lots of multiple award contracts. One of our last counts, we had over 1,500 term contracts. Now, that's not inherently a bad thing based on the some of the premises behind that, including giving customer agencies what they want and distributing work to lots of vendors, including lots of Minnesota vendors. Agencies and the vendor community tend to be pretty happy with that. But the state isn't taking full advantage of its spending power when we do our purchasing that way. A number of states and private sector firms are moving to an approach that is frequently labeled as strategic procurement or spend management. And the primary shift in the philosophy here is that best value is no longer determined at an individual agency level, but at more of an enterprise level. That might not sound like a very big deal, but in terms of actual operating decisions, it can be a pretty huge shift in our fundamental philosophy. The state procurement director in Delaware has defined strategic procurement there as getting agency customers what they need, not what they want. lots of states have tackled this approach with multi-million dollar contracts with firms that specialize in this. Accenture, McKinsey, Silver Oaks are all examples of companies that will come into a state and promise big savings for big dollars. The reaction from our procurement colleagues in other states is pretty mixed as to the value of those consultants. And realistically, in Minnesota, we know that there's no multi-million dollar resource available to help us with this. But I think we're either optimistic or naive enough to believe that we could do much of this with our state resources. I think the size of the potential savings we're talking about depends on how much of the opportunity we would choose to bite off, and frankly, how much pushback we're willing to take from some of the adversely affected parties. This isn't a situation where I could tell you that we could expect big savings without any pain. I don't think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there, but we do think there is the potential for savings with this, if we make this conscious shift in procurement strategy. The concepts I'm talking about are consistent, at least in the big picture sense, with what you'll be hearing in the Drive to Excellence recommendations as those come out over the next few days or weeks. You know, and actually, I'm sorry, I skipped over. I've been trying to talk about a slide that you weren't seeing. This is the one I should have had up. And now we're going to get the one you've been trying to make coincide with my presentation. What would change if we moved to more of the strategic procurement approach? I think there would be some evolution in the roles of the Central Procurement Office and the individual agencies. The Commissioner of Administration now has the authority to make most procurement decisions or to delegate those procurement decisions to agencies. And the balance of what's centralized versus decentralized would shift somewhat based on this more enterprise-wide approach. This would actually continue a longer-term trend of the central procurement people spending less time on the lower-value transactions and more time on the higher-dollar work, including more time on market analysis, contract negotiations, and so forth. Now, those of us in admin tend to think there are two fairly big savings opportunities tied to this strategic procurement concept. And let me talk a little bit about each of them. The first is to move toward an enterprise-wide approach to standardization of goods and really consolidating the supply base. This is especially relevant in the area of IT commodities. Again, it goes back to the concept of getting agencies what they need rather than what they want. To move in this direction, we would need to reduce the number of contracts and substantially reduce the number of makes and models of products that are available on contract. The underlying concept is pretty simple, and it's that if we commit more of the state's dollars to fewer vendors, we can drive down pricing. Just an example of how that can work. Minnesota already manages the largest multi-state hardware contract in the country. Most state agencies across the country use these contracts because it involves a $2 billion a year spend on computer hardware. So the pricing is pretty good based on that volume. The state of Alaska decided that they wanted to get an even deeper discount off that price, so their governor imposed an acceptable Alaska configuration for desktop computers. And by limiting the choice that dramatically, and it's not just one configuration, there are a couple options, by limiting the choice that dramatically, Alaska was able to start with that multi-state contract price and drive the cost down substantially below that. Now, the Commissioner of Administration really would have the authority to do this now between her responsibilities for the Materials Management Division and the Office of Technology. she really could tell agencies what they're going to buy. But obviously that is that would be controversial with agencies and with vendors. And historically we haven't done that. And I'm not suggesting that I think we should begin arbitrarily imposing standards on agencies. I think if we move in this direction, the intent would be to develop user teams and really charge them with refining the state contracts, limiting the contracts, deciding what makes and models of various products will be available and which will not. We work with user groups now, but we think we could take this concept further and specifically charge them with this mission, and then really use the legal club of the Commission of Administration only in any cases where these agency groups were unable or unwilling to make some of the tough decisions about what we will buy. We've begun working in this direction in a few areas. One where we've had some preliminary meetings with agency users involved cell phones. This one was kind of telling in terms of some of what we're learning. One of the reasons we started there is that when Dana Badgerow came into our department, she actually, I think, was kind of annoyed by the number of cell phone contracts we had. We have 6 contracts with different providers, and they all have multiple plans. And her observation is it would have been easier for her to be told, you know, you can get version A, B, or C, make your choice, and get on with your life, rather than being confronted with this wide, wide range of options and trying to figure out what is the best one for her decision. Then as we started talking to users in agencies, we learned some interesting things. One is that with respect to cell phones, it sounds as though, at least in some cases, the features a person has on a cell phone, his or her cell phone, has nothing to do with what he or she needs on the cell phone, but has more to do with their level in the organization and the sort of the status of what they carry around with them and can flash around at meetings. We also learned that some agencies are buying cell phone plans that are generous enough in terms of the number of minutes that you have so that individual state employees can really use their state plan as their personal cell phone at no additional cost to the state, arguably, because it's within the allowed cap for minutes. But in a more coordinated world with respect to cell phone usage, one might prefer to have those minutes pooled on a agency or statewide basis so that it wouldn't be responsible or ethical for the individual to be tapping into this pool for their own use. So this looks like an opportunity, an example of the kind of thing that we would be excited about pursuing further. A number of states are working on IT standardization with varying degrees of success. Alaska, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Missouri, Nevada, North Dakota have all been in communication with us about their efforts and what's worked for them and what hasn't. Another concept that's similar is what we're showing on the slide here is increased coordination and aggregation. That's saying not only would we have fewer makes and models available on fewer contracts, but we would do more to orchestrate the timing and volume of the purchasing from the contracts, combining purchasing from different agencies and so forth, again with the intent of driving the discounts deeper. The second of the two big changes in philosophy or strategy that I think would make a meaningful difference is much more aggressive management of pricing on professional technical contracts. Unlike other goods and services, professional technical contracts are the responsibility of agency heads rather than the Department of Administration. Admin has oversight on these contracts, but we're not the actual party who does the initial contract. Under current law, there's a requirement that there be some consideration of price in evaluating responses to professional technical contracts. But the statute doesn't say how much that consideration of price might be. And there are even a few exceptions in the law where there doesn't need to be any consideration of price until after you've picked the vendor that you want to work with. So as we review professional technical contracts coming in from agencies and the evaluation processes they're using, we routinely see that price is evaluated at about 5 to 15% of the total points awarded in the evaluation process. As we've talked with an admin as to what we think might be more appropriate, we would tend to go more in the range of 40% on price unless there's some good reason to the contrary. The other thing we see is that lots of, frequently, agencies rank their vendors and simply pay that top-ranked vendor the amount that was proposed as the cost. And in the RFP process, that's not unlawful, but you're not taking advantage of your lawful authority to negotiate price once you've selected that vendor. So we think that a more concerted effort by the agencies on managing costs of professional technical contracts could really pay off. Just let me remind you of how much we're spending in some of these areas. Architects and engineers, $105 million in 2004. Computer programmers, $50 million. Advertising and marketing professionals, $6 million. And a combination of other non-IT professionals, $108 million. So we're talking in excess of $250 million a year. So even a modest decrease in that amount of money would be significant for the state. Now, this is one that would take either a statute or an executive order to make this happen because, again, the formal responsibility for these contracts lies with the individual agencies and not the Department of Administration. So let me just wrap up here. Clearly, there are some things that we can be doing within the current statutes that would that we believe would save the state money. It does involve some reshifting of emphasis and priorities. It's not painless. There would be winners and losers. In some instances, we would require changes in statutes to do some of the things that we've talked about. My goal here today is really to begin to describe some of these opportunities to you. If these are the directions that the governor and the legislature would like us to go, we're really excited about working from some of these perspectives. So we're happy to provide more information, meet with interested members, or do whatever would be helpful to facilitate your understanding or your decisions in this area. If I haven't gotten to the types of things you wanted to hear about this morning, ask questions or bring us back at a later date with some new topics.
Okay, Mr. Allen, what we're going to try to do in a timely way is we're going to spend a little time on leases and buildings and parking and stuff, but we're going to spend a little time on procurement. One thing I had is this Mr. Walls left a packet in each member's packets. It's this kind of nice-looking blue thing. He also has an email he sent he'd like distributed to the committee talking about some of the problems he sees as a vendor with contracts. He's a small to mid-sized vendor, claims that the WISCA contract boxes out small to mid-sized vendors who can give us better deals on prices, but they're boxed out because of some requirements. He thinks we give no consideration on purchasing from Minnesota-based vendors as opposed to someone from Montana or Washington or whatever. Could you just address, I don't know if you even have one of these, but could you address some of those concerns and represent Con as a question that's maybe along these lines? But I have heard from some vendors that it's very difficult to get onto the state contract, and what can we do to change if it's laws that are the problem? Give us some ideas or some language from admin where we can make it simpler, easier to follow, easier to get onto. If we're getting good value for a dollar, why aren't we doing this? Give us some thoughts on that. And do you have one of these?
Yeah, I just got it. Okay. So I haven't had a chance to look at it, although we've heard from this gentleman in the past as well.
assuming his packet and email is similar to what I've seen previously, he's raising a concern as it relates to this multi-state hardware contract that I mentioned that Minnesota operates. And this, the issue he raises gets to one of the philosophical and strategic decisions that you as the policymakers need to make with respect to how we manage state procurement. The WISCA contracts are with manufacturers that service the entire country, and that the majority of states want to have available on contract. I think that Mr. Waltz is, he may be a reseller or he may be a manufacturer. But in either event, he didn't qualify for this multi-state contract. And this gets to the heart of the whole strategic procurement strategy and whether you want to adopt it, because the multi-state contract limits the number of vendors that are going to be available for state use and consolidates it limits the choices. But by limiting the choices, it improves the pricing. So you can conclude that it's a good thing to save the money, which is the sort of underlying philosophy of the strategic procurement approach, or you can distribute the work as the state's business as broadly and widely as possible, which would be to Mr. Waltz's advantage, if I'm remembering his circumstance. But we don't think that that's the key to the best pricing for the state.
Mr. Allen, he has on 1, 2, 3, the fourth page, that the WISCA pricing is higher in most cases, and that's why I thought when it's a Dell WISCA pricing is higher than Dell normal website pricing, and very few computer bids are in the state, and small businesses have to go through the bid process, and it's tough to get on that. And he has come and seen me for a few minutes, and he claims in many cases that if they were allowed to open up the monopoly process, that there would be a better price. It's just they aren't even allowed to get on to compete to start with. Do you have any...
Well, Mr. Chair, no one is ever required by law to use the WISCA contracts. I mean, they are available if it's concluded that the use of those contracts is in the financial best interest of the entity that's doing the purchasing. So there's no situation in which a state agency or a local unit of government couldn't do a competitive bid as an alternative to using those WISCA contracts. So I would take exception to a claim that the Dell WISCA pricing is higher than the Dell normal pricing, because the Dell WISCA pricing is based on a $2 billion a year aggregation of public sector business. So it's pretty unlikely that a person buying one computer from their home is going to be offered a better pricing than state government buying in that volume.
I'll have you look this over, and maybe we'll have conversations about this another time, but I just wanted to get that on the table. We have Representative Kahn and Representative Hilty. Representative Kahn, can you pull your microphone down?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Allen, several years ago I carried your procurement reform bill, which Senator Knutson carried in the Senate, and he had no trouble, and I ran into a buzzsaw in the House mainly. As always, I can't remember what the issue was. I just remember who was on each side of the fight. So I'm sorry Representative Prinky isn't here because we could do it. But what was left to do in that bill, which we couldn't do because of my good friend who's not here today? And is that something that we should do? And are there unmet needs and what?
What didn't you do? I think it was a fight about best value, but I'm not.
Mr. Allen, will the department be coming up with some suggestions? It says we could use some changing of laws. You know, will you be coming up with some language for us to kind of look at?
And this time, Representative Sizer was carried with it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, we'd be happy to work with some of you in doing that. We've had some conversations with the Governor's Office in the context of the Drive to Excellence recommendations and whether those should initiate a bill this session or in the future. I don't think any final decision's been made on that, although we don't have a bill in process. If you're hearing anything in any of the discussion that you'd like to pursue, again, we'd be happy to work with any of you in terms of language to accomplish the things we're discussing. And Representative Kahn, the big fight when we worked with you on the procurement reform bill in 98 was whether the construction industry should be included in the concept of best value. And they were pulled out, and we continue to use a more traditional low bid process for the most part in construction, although there's a bill this year that expands the methods for appropriate construction procurement to include some design build options and others. So I mean, at this point I wouldn't say that there's really unleft needs from that. The things I'm
so now that Prinky's busy with taxes and Seifert is doing.
We could slip a few more things through.
Yeah.
Issues. It strikes me that really what we're talking about here in procurement is a lot the same as the kind of issue that we see between Walmart and Main Street businesses. You know, I think we need to consider not just immediate lowest price in these purchasing arrangements, but also the general benefit to the state as a whole. You know, you think about the Walmart thing. Do we want to circulate the money in Minnesota, or do we want to ship it off to a handful of billionaires in Arkansas? We have sort of the same issue with state purchasing, and I hope that we will continue these discussions.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. Members, I did Mr. Wall's packet, if everybody could get that out. It's one that looks like this. If you were to take the, Mr. Allen, you have this too. If you were to take the fifth last page, he's got black and white printers listed on a chart here. And the WISCA contract apparently is the chart that's typed up, and the handwritten items on the top is his company is called Unique Software, and his price on each one of these that I could see is lower. Now, I don't know if he looked at the WISCA contract and then just kind of penciled these in and said, I can do a better deal if I go down a couple bucks in each one or whatever, but you know, if this is a Minnesota company and we can do it cheaper, Representative Hilty, we're actually getting both. We're getting the local guy and the better price, which I think is really, you know, we need to talk about this in more detail than what we have time for now. But if there is truth to this, and small to mid-sized vendors who are Minnesota-based vendors can do it cheaper based upon the information they're giving us, and we're keeping the jobs local, and keeping the amount of money circulating in downtown St. Paul. And this goes to, you know, do we give consideration, for example, if the Ford plant provides trucks for the DNR as opposed to someone else? Is it worth us supporting the Ford plant over maybe saving $2 a truck from some other plant out of Michigan or out of Japan or whatever? But is it worth having those jobs in St. Paul and so forth? I think we need to kind of think about this, and I often criticize of being a micromanager, but I think these things are worth us exploring. So if you maybe have a comment on this either now or later, I think we are going to have another hearing on this later, but if you could kind of investigate it a little bit and see if you can
Panther. This is kind of tough to dump it on you now, but
yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to go back and compare some of the numbers and see if and assess the
situation.
The situation for you.
Okay. Representative Solberg, and then we'll move on to the next one.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate those comments, and I think you can extend that also to such things as where the Department of Human Services contracts with the company on some of their services and puts all those people in India. And we could have those jobs here in the state of Minnesota equally as well.
I think we tried to stop that last year, but Senator Chaudhary shut that down in the Senate.
Well, I understand that we should still be able to do it.
Okay. Excellent. We'll have this discussion, Mr. Allen, in the future as well. Are you doing agency relocation, or is that...
I am not.
Okay. If the members of admin were going to do lease management, rents, parking, and agency relocation, and we're going to try to... if we can, try to keep this presentation portion down and be done so we can get to our bills because we have out-of-town testifiers that I wanted to get to by 9:30 if that's possible. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nikki Gincola, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for Facilities in the Department of Administration. And we were asked to return and provide a few follow-up comments regarding agency relocation, lease management, and parking. And I thought we'd start with agency relocation and just a little bit of information regarding our funding methodology and also admin's role in carrying agency relocation requests. Just a little background. Prior to capital budget reform, which was in the early 1990s, I understand, individual agencies included relocation funding requests in their own operating budgets. With the implementation of the capital budget reform, it was determined that in a capital bonding year, our capital budget year, I'm sorry, agency relocation funds would be included in the in admin's capital budget as a general fund request. And as a reference to that, you can find the policy and process in the Department of Finance's Capital Budget User Manual. The intended purpose is to provide review and approval to gain consistency across the agencies and to provide oversight management and organization. The funds are appropriated to admin, but they are expended by the agencies. And admin's role in all of this is to ensure that expenditures are made in accordance with the established plan and budget. And again, the detailed process for this is in the Department of Finance's Capital Budget User Manual. I just thought I'd point out as well that there are three ways that relocation costs may be funded. The first is agency relocation requests within existing base budgets. The second is what I just described in terms of the capital budget. It's intended to fund major agency relocations. It's reviewed by admin, and if it is approved, they're included in a multi-agency capital budget request, and this is almost always the method used for these major relocation requests. And then the third one is in a biennial budget. And this is the request method used if it's not possible to wait for a capital budget request or to reallocate internal resources. So it's presented then as an agency biennial budget initiative.
Okay.
What's the latest number on that relocation along building implementation?
DHS.
That's the only question I had on that slide.
Our total agency relocation is $6,752,000, and of that, the Department of Human Services is $4.674 million.
Okay.
Okay. The second piece that we were asked to address is lease management, and you should have in your packet two summarized lease reports that were just handed out this morning.
Members, did you get the newest lease by square foot? Representative Krinke asked for that. I also was kind of interested in when these leases expire and what the term, the year terms were, but I didn't see those on there. But that's,
okay, in your,
we'll get that another day.
Mr. Chair,
are they 10-year leases, 5-year leases?
There is a detailed breakdown for each, and I just want to point out that there are two separate reports. One is labeled departmental leases, and that is the state-owned property report. And then there's the commercial, which is the non-state-owned leases. And so you're seeing a summary of departmental. It's about 1.5 million square feet and annual rent of $24.7 million. And on the commercial side, it's about 4.1 million square feet and an annual rent of $60.9 million. Okay. Real estate management, which is a division within the Department of Administration, has statewide responsibility for leasing space for most state agencies, and the Commissioner of Administration is granted authority to lease. There are three types of leases held by the state. The first is the commercial leases, second is departmental, and the third is income. And the income leases, this is space within state-owned buildings that we sublease to other people. There are approximately 151 of those.
And then, is there a report on vacant buildings similar to the Ford building is sitting there with not really anyone in it? There's a building next to the church, I think, that's just kind of sitting there. Do we have an idea of how many of those properties we have that are buildings in either primo locations or even non-primo locations that either we need to figure out what we're going to do with them or sell them? Has there been any discussion on that?
Mr. Chair, there is a listing. I don't have it with me today, but admin does have a list of the surplus space in state-owned buildings.
Okay.
And we can provide
that. Can we get a copy
that
of that at
some
point? That would be great. Thank you.
Okay, and then the only other point someone had raised yesterday, Mr. Chair, is the type of leases in terms of how they're negotiated. All of our commercial leases are negotiated at a gross level. One additional point that I would like to make is that the Real Estate Management Division has a process that they follow in leasing. It's the policy and procedure and the guidelines are contained in the Real Estate Leasing Guide. It describes the processes of site location, including economic analysis and comparison. It includes space planning, and it also includes lease negotiation, preparation, and execution. And it's all designed to meet the agency's space requirements in the most economical manner possible. The guide also explains the process of resolving leased space-related problems and lease compliance issues, and it's also the manner in which real estate management assures compliance of leases to all the applicable policies and statutes.
Okay, any other questions on lease management right now, members? Representative LaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple brief questions. The first question I had is if you look at some of the lease rates, they're starting to get up well over $20 a square foot, and I guess I'll make an assumption that those are gross leases. Why are we entering into leases at market rates that are really up at the high end?
Mr. Chair, my name is Beverly Croyce. I'm the Director of the Real Estate Management Division. Some of the leases that we've negotiated that are at $20 or slightly over $20 were negotiated when the market rental rates were much higher 3 or 4 years ago. Right now we're finding that the market rates, at least in the larger cities, are in the range of $18, depending upon the improvements to the space. We're at the end of most of those leases, and leases that we have that are over $20, we've taken a look at all of those to try to renegotiate those. And for the most part, we've negotiated the majority of the leases that are over $20 lower than that.
And I do have a bill relating to this as well that we may or may not get to today that basically says the commissioner is supposed to do an analysis of the prevailing similar market rates and not enter into agreements that exceed that.
Right.
Go ahead.
Right, and you're right, Mr. Chairman. It's hard, but you look at St. Paul. I mean, they've had negative absorption for a period of time. I think vacancy rates in the CBD in St. Paul are over 24%. You know, the market is very favorable to lessees, and I hope we would take advantage of that in addition to looking at Class C space. I don't think that the state needs to be renting Class A space just like, to me, it's similar to Cadillacs for the state carpool. I mean, the Chevy works. The other question I had, Mr. Chairman, quickly is, the state is negotiating, and I'm talking about with non-state-owned property right now. Do you take co-brokers commissions when you negotiate these leases?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, we do not.
How come?
For the most part, we deal with the owners themselves. And where we do deal with real estate agents, they're exclusively paid by the owner of the building. But we do not hire a real estate agent on our behalf to collect a commission. And for the most part, our rental rates reflect the fact that there is not a commission in the rental rate.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I mean, you look at a rule of thumb if you represent somebody for at least, I mean, it's $3 a square foot. I mean, that's money that potentially could be going to the state. Other than that, you know, those fees are going all on the other side of the table. So I would suggest anybody, you know, for the most part, although situations are unique, but anybody representing a landlord dealing with the state, that's a pretty sweet deal to get $5 or $6 in commission per square foot. You know, and so you've got that issue. I think another issue to look at, Mr. Chairman, is people know if you buy a house, if you're strictly looking to buy a house or lease something, you don't pay commissions to anybody. That all comes from the other side of the table. And so maybe we should look at a fact that we should simply go out on an RFP and ask for, you know, any one of a number of commercial real estate brokerages out there to represent the state, because it would come at no cost to the state. They would make their money by getting a commission from the landlord. I would certainly like to hear an argument against doing that, because as far as I can see, that would simply come at no cost whatsoever to the state of Minnesota. And other than that, I think the state ought to look at least at trying to, wherever possible, get co-broker commissions, which could bring revenue into the state. But I just think we're missing the boat here on something.
Representative Krenke?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Chris, what are the lease rates going to be in the new DHS building and the office, new health ag office building?
Ms. Croy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Department of Administration Plant Management Division sets those rental rates, and I don't know what those have been estimated at the moment. I think there's a representative from the division that can answer that question.
Mr. Roberts, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Roberts, do you, I thought we had seen information on what those lease rates were going to be previously. Do you remember?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krenke, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I'm sure I do have that information somewhere.
My Mr. Chairman, my recollection is that they were going to be north of $35 a square foot. So you can see in relationship to what the lease rates that we're paying in other areas. So so much for the idea of it's cheaper to own rather than to lease. Just might make members aware of that. So I know that Representative Bishop is no longer here. Of course, he was the king of rental property himself, but he thought that it was cheaper for the state to own rather than to lease. But did we come up with some idea what those numbers are?
We did, Representative Krenke. The Ag Health Lab Building, for fiscal year 06, is $28.69 per square foot. The Freeman Building for fiscal year 06, $35.28.
That's the.
To be occupied by Agriculture and Health.
Okay, 35. I'm sorry, Ms. Cross.
$35.28. And then for the Anderson Building to be occupied by Human Services, $34.34 per square foot.
Mr. Chair.
That would be Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Solberg.
Do you have the rental for the revenue building?
Ms. Croy?
What we are right now.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I believe it's at $15 and...
Okay, I'm sorry.
$0.15.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Does that
Representative Solberg?
Does that rental?
And it would still be Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, I thought he was back again, though, so that's why I'm sorry.
She's got the way to keep it.
If you're like me, you can call me anything. Just don't call me late for supper. Does that rent reflect the payment of the bonds as well?
Ms. Kreis?
Madam Chairman, Representative Solberg, the rental rates for state-owned buildings includes operating costs, a depreciation amount, and then interest on the bonds.
Well, Mr. Chairman, but or Madam Chair, the,
Representative Solberg,
those buildings were, I think, were financed by the St. Paul Port Authority. Were they not?
Ms. Kreis?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, what I just described was how the rental rates are calculated for state-owned facilities. The facilities that will be occupied by Ag Health Office and by the Department of Human Services were lease purchased through the Port Authority selling bonds. Those bonds are to be paid back over a 21-year period. So the debt service includes the payment of the principal and the interest on those bonds.
So, Madam Chair, that's the reason for the difference, because we weren't up front about how we should finance those to begin with. And there was a certain mayor that wanted to have those downtown St. Paul, and of course Representative Finke and I think both were saying we should at least not build some of those buildings in the most expensive type of buildings we have. It doesn't make any sense to have a lab on the Capitol grounds.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Solberg, I heard this morning on the radio that the bonding bill is still open, so if people wanted to do the right thing, we could use state bond financing. We could greatly pay down the cost of those leases and take care of that financing situation yet this year.
Would you be go to the governor's office and say we could do more, or the speaker's office and say do more than 880? Because you're right, that could be. And it would be kind of interesting to know what the interest rate is as well.
Representative Kahn?
I think that one of the issues, I was involved in that fight too, so he's kind of on the same side as the big guy. I thought one of the things was that there wasn't going to be a penalty in buying those bonds down. That was one of the things that you could do them at any time. You could take them over to the state and not. Because often there's a default provision if you buy bonds down early, but there isn't in these buildings. So we could just do the default.
We want a little more give and take, Madam Chair.
One more round
of Representative
Finke.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I wasn't talking about going above 880. just in case you might have thought about that, I was thinking maybe we could do a little less on some of the other projects that people want currently and pay off our past debts instead of incurring more than the, I think we're about $6 billion in debt now. Maybe we could hold that down so we didn't have to go to $7
billion. Well, Madam Chair, I'll just do a little bit more history, too. At one time when we did pay cash, we went from the Democratic control to Republican control, and the first thing we did on the cash of those buildings was you guys borrowed money so that you could give it back, $400 million with additional debt.
Ms. Giancola, could you go on to Capitol Parking, and then we'll do Drive to Excellence probably on another day.
Madam Chair? Yep. On Capitol Complex Parking, I believe you all received a copy of the draft commuter policy. And it was delivered to your offices around 3:14, and I think you all have a copy of the cover memo from our commissioner. It was sent to state agency heads, HR directors, the legislature, House and Senate Sergeant-at-Arms, and the Congressionally Chartered Vets organizations. And in it, I just wanted to talk about the fact that we outline a projected shortage of approximately 855 stalls this fall when the new buildings under construction are finally occupied. The demand will, in fact, outstrip the supply. And the point that managing our existing resources, what we have today, is going to be key to effectively addressing this challenge. Our policy emphasizes, first and foremost, equity and fairness. It also addresses optimum utilization of parking facilities that we have. It ensures employee access to alternative transportation, and it addresses employee safety, all those things taken into account. The key elements of the policy are that current contract holders will retain their parking. New contracts will be assigned by lottery. Admin is working on additional solutions, and some of those are that we have a capital bonding request in for $1.9 million approximately for expansion of Lot Q and the Centennial Office Building ramp. We plan to expand commercial leasing of stalls in the downtown area. We're going to try incentives for people to, you know, try the bus, use MetroPass, try a remote facility, encourage car and van pooling, all of those alternative transportation things. And the fact that our parking rates then are set to ensure recovery of expenses. I do want to point out that the bonded projects of expansion of Lot Q and the Centennial Office Building ramp in and of themselves are to be user financed and will not affect the rates. However, admin does have an ongoing responsibility to meet the obligations for our operating costs, and we do expect those rates to increase and be adjusted. But they are not as a result of the two bonded projects that we are asking for. So I think those were the points that we wanted to highlight, particularly around the commuter policy. It is out there right now for comment, and we are receiving comments in plant management. When the comment period ends, we will take all of those into account, and we will put forth instructions on how to apply for the lottery for the existing spaces, but again, it's the key is to effectively manage what we have.
Representative Kranke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 2, can you tell me what the difference between a car, a truck, and a sport utility vehicle is?
Ms. Giancola?
Madam Chair, Representative Kranke, of the policy itself?
Yes, on page 2, Roman numeral 2, commuting options. It says single occupancy vehicles, including cars, trucks, and sport utility vehicles. What's the difference between a car, a truck, and a quote-unquote sport utility vehicle?
Representative Kranke, in terms of occupancy?
Well, in terms of anything.
Kranke.
I don't, Madam Chair, vehicle registration, GVW, operation, I mean, my point is, why is sport utility vehicle specified cars and trucks? I think cars and trucks covers virtually everything that would be in terms of anything.
Frankie.
I don't, Madam Chair, vehicle registration, GVW, operation, I mean, my point is, why is sport utility vehicle specified cars and trucks? I think cars and trucks covers virtually everything that would be a licensed passenger vehicle on the road. Why do we single out sport utility vehicles? Are they a certain type or classification of vehicle?
Ms. Giancola?
Madam Chair, Representative Kranke, I'm not sure. There is no specification for it. We're including them all.
Department got some, you know, somebody want to, I mean, somebody writing with political correctness here? Is that they want to...
Ms. Giancola?
Madam Chair, Representative Crick, yeah.
Do we have...
Maybe we could just, as I said, I don't think we need politically correct language when we're talking about parking and commuting policy, so...
So noted.
Thanks for coming, Ms. Giancola.
You're welcome.
Ms. Price. We need to move on, and we will have Representative Seifert up with House File number 658.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'll just move House File 658 for consideration. We're going to lay all these bills over this morning, but I have some people who wanted to testify, or at least one person, potentially two. We're going to try to keep it brief because I know we have some out-of-town testifiers here for Representative Finstead's bill. Members, what this bill basically does is allows the commissioner to consider purchasing used goods when buying state materials. And this isn't something where we have rusty station wagons and so forth, but if you look at, just to give an example, the legislature has laptops. And instead of buying kind of the best of everything, I kind of wonder, we got five basic functions we need, in my opinion. Legislators need access to email, internet, spreadsheets, Word document, and I've used it for PowerPoint when I gave a presentation to a graduate class last year. But I think in a lot of cases we buy more fancier things than what we need. And I have some gentlemen who refurbish computers and sell them at a much lower price, and they aren't very old and so forth. I'd like to give some testimony for members just to consider this. This isn't a mandate or requirement. This is something for us to think about. I'd like the gentleman to come down, identify themselves, and give some brief testimony if they'd be able to.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dahl.
This is Mr. Dahl.
Oh, Dahl. Excuse me.
Madam Chairman. My name is Ryan Labor, and I represent the Asset Recovery Corporation. Over the last 15 years, domestic computer sales have climbed from 9.8 million units in 1990 to projections of over 56 million by the end of 2005. This fivefold growth over the last 15 years is a result of two primary factors. The first is the lowering cost of a common desktop computer. The second is the drive for digital access to common office needs, such as word processing, spreadsheets, and email. However, many of our everyday office needs do not require high-end processors. Second-hand or used computer equipment presents an opportunity to save substantially on the acquisition of replacement hardware and should be considered as an option during the procurement process. There are several reasons why the state of Minnesota and its procurement professionals should consider the purchase of used equipment. First, business procurement professionals commonly purchase used goods, as you'll note in the handout. According to a 2002 survey conducted by a widely popular IT magazine, CIO, over 77% of survey respondents buy secondhand or used computer equipment. Common equipment types include desktop PCs, servers, and networking hardware. Number two, Minnesota has the second highest number of used computer dealers in the country. In a 2002 study conducted by Processor Magazine, 65 independent used computer dealers were identified in the state of Minnesota alone. This is second only to California, which has 93. These vendors not only provide used equipment, but can support and service the products they sell. Vendors range in size from local shops to multi-million dollar resellers. Number three, the cost savings are substantial, and I'll refer you to the very last page of the handout. According to the previously mentioned CIO survey, used equipment can save organizations between 50 to 75% off the price of equipment. When comparing the cost of a new Dell PC under the current state of Minnesota contract versus a used PC from an asset recovery corporation, the savings are evident. A new common Dell PC, 2.8 gigahertz processor speed with common configurations, a standard operating system, and a three-year warranty, cost $786. A unit of similar configuration with the exception of a slightly slower processor speed at 1 gigahertz, which is fully capable of meeting almost all office needs in common office environments, with a two-year warranty, costs $340, and that's with recycling services at the end of the life of that unit included. the potential long-term savings of multiple computer sales at this price level are substantial. I've thrown some numbers at you there, but essentially, assuming 1,000 PCs are bought at this lower rate over the course of a year would save the state of Minnesota $446,000 alone. For years, the business community has reaped the cost benefits of used computers. Minnesota's used technology marketplace is capable of meeting many computing needs at a substantially lower cost, and the state of Minnesota is capable of integrating used hardware into the computer base. The state of Minnesota, as many of you are aware, currently operates its own redeployment program by which agencies, once material has been identified as being surplus, is then redistributed to other agencies. Your IT staff is prepared for it. With a clear directive to consider secondhand equipment, the agencies and offices throughout the state can look forward, hopefully, to reducing costs and saving taxpayer money.
Thank you, Mr. Labor.
Questions and
is Mr. Dahl going to offer testimony as well?
No, I'm not presenting this case from
there. Okay. Any questions I can help with?
Moral support.
Okay. Representative Kahn?
Yes, Madam Chairman, on that last page, looking at the new Dell PC and the ARC used PC, the big difference is the number of gigahertz. How would that affect the use of it?
Mr. Labor?
Madam Chairwoman and Representative, the base requirement for a Windows XP professional operating system is 233 megahertz. For any of us that have ever tried to operate that operating system on a PC of that speed, it takes quite a bit of time. However, you would find anything in the 500 to 600 megahertz range would be able to operate that operating system at a rather good speed. Currently, the state of Minnesota redeploys PCs in the 600 megahertz and above range. A 1 gigahertz unit will be able to meet virtually all basic office needs. The only requirements you may need to increase that processor speed is for complicated or large software programs, such as civil engineering or CAD software programs, or other complex databases tend to be custom made. The lifespan of a 1 gigahertz used computer will be quite long. The 1 gigahertz is approximately 2 to 3 years of in age. Most of these units come out of leasing environments. You'll find if you were to network with some of the IT executives throughout the state of Minnesota that, for example, Northwest Airlines is using units that are much less than 1 gigahertz in speed. It would be able to meet all your basic needs.
Yeah. So
that's the explanation of why you're on a hold up several very long time trying to get any information from them. That's why.
No. Common use for their PCs are mostly at the stations, actually in the airports. There are obviously going to be needs beyond what the leasing environment can provide or used computer dealers can provide. I can tell you, for example, that even in our company, where almost everything in our organization is used, we bought a new server to meet our needs. We don't expect that used computer sales can cover every single IT need for the state.
Representative Hilfe, do you have a question?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. Sir, when at one point you mentioned when you were talking about recycling at the end of the useful life of the equipment, mm-hmm. How is that calculated? When we talk about the useful life, do we mean that you just use it until it crashes, or is there some kind of rule of thumb for that?
Mr. Labor?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's basically made, the decision is made by the user of the unit itself. You'll find many environments where a 1 gigahertz computer may only last for another couple to 3 years. However, I would suspect through Minnesota's redeployment program that a 1 gigahertz computer will likely last the state of Minnesota another 5 to 6 years in a number of different environments. The type of materials that can be recycled will vary. We find that we get companies that send us, Mr. Dahl actually had an experience with a civil engineering firm that was getting rid of 2.8 gigahertz machines because they need the faster processors to operate their software programs. However, given the breadth of services the state of Minnesota provides and the breadth of needs they have for computers, I would suspect that it would be several years down the road before these would be disposed of. And it would be the determination as far as when it is scrapped is made by surplus services or the agency working with surplus services as to whether or not the unit can be redeployed. If it's not redeployed, currently, actually, we also maintain the contract for the state of Minnesota for the disposal of all computer equipment coming out of state-related agencies.
Other questions, members? Representative Krinke.
My suggestion, Madam Chair, to the author would be that you name this the Why Buy New When Slightly Used Will Do Bill.
Representative Byford?
Members, in wrapping this up, these gentlemen, if you haven't picked up on this, are pretty bright. And I think there are, not obviously not for everything, but I think there are some limited places where we could utilize these services. And I'm not seen as the recycling king, but for environmental types, Representative Kahn, I don't think this is a bad idea in limited situations to be recycling very good, usable computers, and it's a homegrown Minnesota business. I didn't know that we were the second biggest state that had these remanufactured facilities, and they have warranties on them, so if there's a problem, you replace them. So to me, it's something at least worth considering for us to think about.
Representative Kahn?
Madam Chairman, I know one of the things you've talked about is requiring the recycling price to be considered in the purchase price. Have we ever done that? Have we had a bill to be looked at it or not done it?
Mark,
but it seems if this table is true, that would just, you know, that alone would certainly make it.
Representative Kahn, that sounds like rider language.
I know there's been a lot of objection. I thought, well, we try to require that. Maybe we should. But some other states do it.
That sounds like good writer language.
About that.
We'll see if Mr. Shepard might be able to inform us. And this issue will be back again, Madam Chair, too, but I just want to get the initial committee reaction on it. And, okay. And Representative Vincent is out-of-town people, so we want to get to him quickly.
I do want to give admin an opportunity to respond if they wanted to. Anyone?
Do you feel compelled to say anything, or do we want to? I don't want to cut Finstead's bill off too much either, so we need to move very quickly.
Dina Badgerow, Department of Administration, Madam Chair and committee members, we today have the opportunity to purchase used equipment, so I'm not sure that we fully need the statutory authorization to do so. However, the nudge, we do buy used equipment today. We buy used office equipment, used partitions. And furniture, so it isn't without statutory authorization. It's not required. Good idea, and we'd be happy to look at it.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Badgerow. With that, I will move House File 658 for a possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and we'll move on to Representative Finstead, House File 454.
Information system, or GIS, capabilities to help local jurisdictions complete important planning projects. Among other regions, there is one common theme in the work. Local units of government are asking us to update their ordinance books and land use plans. In order to meet a particular community's development needs, we have assisted local communities with grant writing for planning and designing trails and park construction. We have helped develop comprehensive plans which focus on economic development. Other planning tasks that have included in Region 1, they have undertaken the Red River Basin Natural Resource Planning work that needed to be done after the floods of 98. In Region 2, a reservation-wide land use plan for the Red Lake and the Beltrami County Housing Plan. In Region 5, they have not received any grant money under this program, but there are several local jurisdictions in the region who have identified GIS, wastewater, and housing needs that need to be addressed. In Region 6E, they have done a great deal under this program on database and mapping needs of local government or local units of government. In Region 6W and 8, they have helped several cities and counties with comprehensive plans, zoning ordinances, and GIS mapping. Region 9 has worked on local housing needs, capital improvement planning, and comprehensive plan revision. In every case, it is important work which needs to be done. Most of the local units of government we have helped have very limited financial resource and most of them do not have planners on staff. Those jurisdictions that do have staff with some planning expertise typically have these people carry out many other functions for their cities, counties, and townships. This program allows us to extend some matching resources and bring planning expertise to bear on particular planning needs. The plans that we are working on with these local unit of governments will help the mayors, city council members, county commissioners, and township officials decide how to accommodate growth or deal with decline in their respective communities. Whether it is local planning or zoning ordinances, capital improvement plans, housing or economic development, this planning will help local officials make better decisions which conserve valuable and sometimes scarce local resources. This has been a very positive program for small communities in greater Minnesota. I hope that we can continue this work in the next year. I extend my thanks to you for support that you have provided in the past, and I would be pleased to answer any questions that you might have for the work that we do for local governments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ribas. Are you here to testify as well?
Madam Chair, I'm here to answer questions if anybody has.
Okay, thank you. Do we have questions from members? Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, do the regional development organizations have a property tax levy?
Mr. Trustee?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we do. We have local taxing authority under the Regional Development Act.
Representative
Madam
Solberg.
Chair, is there some limitations on that taxing authority?
Mr. Trustee?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there are. There are caps in the statute. The last time the Regional Development Act was opened up in the legislature, and then a specific dollar amount was listed with a 3% cap per year as the amount of the increase, and that's where the language sits currently.
So, Madam Chair, you're able to increase your levy 3% a year?
Up to 3% a year.
Up to. Okay.
Representative Solberg?
Well, the reason I asked that question is because in most of the regional development commissions that I'm aware of, that gives them some support, but most of their services are done on a fee for service, and they charge. Obviously, small towns don't have planners, and they shouldn't, but they do ask the regional development commission if they need of that service that they pay for that service, and then maybe. Just a few thousand dollars for it. I'm kind of curious on why the state is then paying for that. Is this a continuation? One other question, is this a continuation of a program?
Mr. Trustee?
Madam Chair, Representative, it is a continuation. We did receive funding through 2001, I believe.
When?
Through 2001.
Oh,
and
okay.
Then in Governor Ventura's last year we were unallotted as part of that process.
I don't think Governor Ventura did unallotting, did he? Did he do it last year? Is the administration?
Mr. Rubis, do you have an answer to that?
I think the only unallotment was in Governor Plenty's administration.
Mr. Rubis.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Governor Ventura's that administration, we received the funding, but the next year when the freeze or the unallotment came in, that happened before we received those funds.
And that wasn't Mr. Ventura, that was not
Representative Solberg.
Ventura, that was Governor Plenty.
It's Governor Plenty.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Rubis. Members, other questions? Representative Kahn.
I'm interested in how this fits in with the testimony we heard yesterday from LIMIC and LPAC, whatever. How do they fit in with this process?
Mr. Trustee.
Madam Chair, Representative, we use LIMIC as a resource primarily in the Regional Development Commissions. Most of the Regional Development Commissions have various levels of GIS capabilities, but LIMIC is a huge resource for the data that we use in our local planning efforts. And we've worked over the years quite a bit with the local planning assistance office at what was used to be Minnesota Planning and is now in the Department of Administration, very closely on a number of statewide and regional planning efforts.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
John, I'm not sure. Obviously we're going to make our decision as we put the omnibus bill together, but I'm not sure what good cutting that while starting this seems to do. You know, particularly looking on page 2, development of the geographic information systems database to serve a region's need, including hardware and software purchases and related labor costs. But cutting out the state agency that does this, which ought to have a large amount of cost savings efficiency involved in it, and then suddenly paying for it to be done on a regional basis, I'm not sure that makes a lot of sense.
Representative Krenke, do you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Finstead, do you know how many planners are employed by the Metropolitan Council?
Representative Finstead.
Madam Chair, I do not, and I know that you do, so I'd love to hear the answer.
Thank
you. That's one of the things you learn around here, Representative Finstead. Never ask a question you don't know the answer to. I believe the number, I probably depends somewhat on how you classify them, but I think the number is somewhere around 400. So I would suggest that perhaps we work on a little liaison here that these are the I think that I'm totally willing to bring the Metropolitan Council to the other 80 counties in the state of Minnesota. And I always, these are the same people that litigated against the city of Lake Elmo because they weren't densifying as much as they should. And so, as I said, I'll be happy to work with you to bring the Metropolitan Council to the other 80 counties in the state. You have my word on that.
Representative Finstead?
Madam Chair, as being a rural member, I don't know if we want them. You can have them.
Representative Frank.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, isn't that what you're looking for planning assistance, and we want to give you all the assistance you could possibly need. And we have it. They're trained, they're knowledgeable, they have all the information at their fingertips, so I'm sure that WIC is saying any needs that exist out there in the other 80 counties, we will be happy to help you. You can, as I said, you can count on it. I happen to know a member of the Metropolitan Council fairly well, and I'm sure we could...
Are you sure you know her that well?
Well, I said fairly well. I never want to... I would never claim that I truly know or understand.
Okay, members, any further questions? Mr. Trustee, did you have something you want to say?
Madam Chair, I never got a chance to answer Representative Solberg's question on...
Proceed.
On what use the dollars would be for. Typically what's happened in the past is these very small communities and the smaller counties, we use this money to pay down what the contract cost would be so that the community doesn't have to foot the entire cost. It's kind of a buy down to get them. Currently in Commissioner Rubis's county, we've got a community that needs a full ordinance codification but feels that it can't really afford it, so we are kind of going about halfway and doing the organizational things for them. And those are the kind of situations that we use that planning assistance dollars for to help cities like the city of Okemena to afford to be able to actually finish what they're doing.
Madam Chair,
Lieutenant Solberg?
How big is the city of Okemena?
Madam Chair, it's
Mr. Rubis.
Approximately 130 citizens.
Madam Chair, I understand the need for that kind of stuff, but I served as a mayor of a very small city also, and we did pay for our ordinance updates. I'm sure it's, some lawyer time on it, and I understand. I think there's a difference between the planning and an ordinance update. I can understand the state having some interest in planning, because that might have more of a regional effect. But for the state to pay for the city to update its ordinance, I would question that. I think that's a local obligation.
Okay, members, any more questions? Hearing no further questions, the chair will lay over House File 454 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Seifert, if it would be okay with you, I would prefer to hear these bills on a later date.
Madam Chair, we did run up against the clock a little bit today. We are going to bump the surplus property sales and the property leasing issue to next week. Jared, is there anything else that we've got going on? We'll have more bills referred to our committee. And if members have particular questions for the departments relating to these topics, they have been tremendous about getting us everything we've asked for, and I want to thank you for the good job that you've done for that. But our omnibus bill is probably we're going to be aiming for, I think, late April. So if members have ideas you want brought forward, I always like to get them on the table and find out what's wrong or what's right with the ideas before we just slide them in the omnibus bill. With that, I think we're going to end up pushing that off to Tuesday right now for next week.
All right. Thank you, members. With that, this meeting's adjourned.